Welcome to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Beyond Addiction Show. I am your host, Dr. Josh King, and today I'm talking with Dr. Jeffrey Ditzel. He is a psychiatrist here in New York City who, among other things, does ketamine treatments with patients. And this is a relatively new treatment for depression, anxiety, OCD. And Dr. Ditzel is going to join us and help us learn about it some more and understand really how and why it works. Last week, I spoke with Dr. Ian Reed about what our facial expressions tell us and tell others about our intentions and how that impacts our ability and our willingness to trust others. And if you're someone who like me, just really finds that these things that we do that are outside of our awareness to be pretty cool, then this is definitely a good episode for you. The piece that he was talking about crying, like how it just doesn't make sense evolutionarily, like this wetness that comes out of your face when you're upset about something, like why do we do that? And just being able to say like, wow, when we do the research, it shows that it increases somebody's willingness to trust us. And when we think about evolutionarily what it means, you know, you can't see, you're blurry-eyed, you're expressing to somebody else that you're vulnerable and vulnerable to attack, right? You're opening yourself up, which means you can trust me. I'm putting myself out here like that. And that's just like so cool to me. I just think it's so awesome. So if you're into that kind of stuff, this is a good one for you. Next week, we've got a real treat. We're talking with one of the creators of motivational interviewing, among other treatments, several other treatments for substance use. His name is William Miller, Dr. William Miller, and he is such an interesting guy. What a nice guy. And we're going to talk about motivational interviewing, MI, and we're going to talk about how and why different therapists get different results, even if they're doing the exact same treatment. So that is definitely one not to be missed. And lastly, before we go on, I want to talk just briefly a little public service announcement. Last week, we did one about fentanyl showing up in everything and how that's causing all kinds of deaths. Well, this week, we have recently had a big research analysis that from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, the NIAAA, which is part of the National Institute of Health, the NIH. And they looked at alcohol-related causes of death between 1999 and 2017. And the number of deaths that mentioning alcohol as part of the reason of death, it doubled from 1999 to 2017. I just want to put that into context. The amount of deaths that have something to do with alcohol doubled in the last 18 years. That's a lot. We spend a lot of time thinking about the opioid crisis. We spend a lot of time thinking about that epidemic and what that's doing to people. It's dwarfed by the number of deaths due to alcohol. Alcohol deaths were 72,558 in 2017, 2.6% of all deaths in the United States. And of those, nearly half of them were either from liver disease or an overdose on either alcohol alone or alcohol with other drugs. 31% is liver disease, 18% is alcohol related overdose. So this is not something to be taken lightly. This is something to be taken seriously. And when we're thinking about really, you know, what kind of epidemics are out there, what kind of things we need to be thinking about to make sure that we're helping people, let's not forget about the toll that alcohol can take on a person. So let's just keep that in mind. Today, Today, I want to talk to you about something I heard on another podcast, because I'm a pretty regular listener of the excellent, excellent New York Times podcast, The Daily. And I heard a recap of a show that I had actually missed. I think they did a kids version. And this one had a young girl named Ella Mainers. And she was talking about her OCD. She's a 9-year-old girl who's diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. And she talked about how she went to a therapeutic summer camp to help with her OCD. And it just got me thinking, because we've had OCD expert David Yusko on the show talking about ERP, which is exposure and response therapy, in the past. And so I've had real experts on here. I was a little skeptical listening to it, but I was really happily surprised by the entire show. And I wanted to share a few thoughts with you all about it. So first, I think they did a really beautiful job explaining that not all OCD is what most people think about when they think about OCD. When you think about OCD, I think the majority of people think about hand washing, right? Washing your hands over and over again, or touching that doorknob exactly 10 times, or I've got to step, I can only step on no cracks. And if I step on a crack, then it's all gone terribly. I got to go home and start again. That was not Ella's OCD. Her obsessions are her thoughts about her fears. So she had fears that there she would get stuck in a tornado. She lives in a part of the country where there are tornadoes, or that she would get sick and she would vomit. And her obsessions were thoughts about those fears. And then her compulsions were trying to avoid situations where her brain was telling her that that fear may come true. So when she's worrying that she might throw up, her brain tells her that if you go into that room, you're going to throw up. And it says that over and over again. You're going to throw up. You're going to throw up. Go in that room. You're going to throw up. You're going to throw up. That's the obsession. The compulsion for her was then doing anything she can to avoid that room, because she has to avoid throwing up, and her brain has convinced her that it's going to happen if she goes in that room. So she has to avoid it. And so that's the OCD, the obsessive thoughts, and then of you're going to throw up if you go in there, and the compulsion to avoid that by all costs. Now, that's a very typical version of OCD, and it's actually just so different from the version where it's like, all right, how often have you touched that door handle? And because it's not quite so visible, it might go unnoticed or misdiagnosed as something else. It's also something that we have to be able to think that you don't necessarily need a formal diagnosis of OCD in order to be dealing with those types of obsessive thoughts and then compulsive behaviors. Maybe it doesn't rise to the level of OCD, but other people might be dealing with this. So many people have stories that their brains tell them. And the issues that they're dealing with is that they then chronically avoid what their brain is telling them to be a problem. So think about the socially anxious people who are avoiding all kinds of parties or all kinds of social situations because they're just so sure. Their brain has told them so many times. They are so sure that they're going to be awkward when they get there and that then it's not going to work well. And that they're going to show up and it's going to be embarrassing and it's going to be terrible. Or maybe somebody who has had bad or awkward experiences at, let's say, concerts. And then they refuse to go to them anymore because they're worried that I don't know what's going to happen at that concert, but I know it's going to be really bad. And so I cannot go to the concert. I cannot go there. I cannot go there. And so all their friends, their family, other people, they want to go to concerts. They want to do things. Say, no, I can't do that. And so then that puts a rift between you and the people who you care about. And we can do this for a million different situations. These are all forms of the same issue. Now, I'm not trying to create a false equivalency here. I'm not saying that everyone who has a situation like that is exactly the same as somebody like Ella, who is dealing with full-blown OCD, a diagnosable form of obsessive compulsive disorder. Because if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, like Ella, those obsessive thoughts occur to a much larger degree than somebody who's just nervous about going to a concert. At the same time, if the person who is experiencing some distressing thoughts that they can't control, and then they're dealing with those distressing thoughts by regularly and sometimes compulsively avoiding that thing, it can exacerbate an issue and make it rise to the level of something that they might really want to be seeking help for, right? There are many people who have trouble going to school or trouble going to work. And we don't necessarily say, all right, you definitely have OCD, but that they're dealing with the same kind of obsessive thoughts about what's going to happen at work, what's going to happen at school. I'm really freaking out. I'm really worried about it. And now I'm compulsively avoiding that situation because I just am so terrified that what I'm afraid of is going to come true. So that's the first thing that I think this program did, was highlight a really important way of looking at and thinking about OCD. The second thing that they did was Ella's mom brought up something very important that kind of went a little under the radar in the episode, that reassuring Ella by saying that she won't get sick or there won't be a tornado actually didn't help. And that it was amplifying her fears. So this is an important point about OCD. People who are struggling with obsessive thoughts often engage in reassurance-seeking behaviors. And that these are behaviors that they think will help reduce the obsessions and ultimately reduce the discomfort that they're feeling. Right? It's like the person who's nervous about going to that party and asking their friends over and over again, do I look good? How do I look? Is Dave going to be there? I really like Dave. Dave is cool. Is Dave going to be there? Because then I know that there's someone for me to talk to. And the problem with reassuring someone like that, who's in that cycle, is that first, it doesn't really work that well. Ella points this out. She said that Ella's brain was stuck on the problem, so no amount of reassurance was really going to help her. But the second piece is by giving a person what they're looking for in that moment, it actually teaches them that this process of reassurance seeking, it should continue. Even if it's not working, it should continue because it does get results. Like the person actually tried to reassure you. So maybe that'll work at some point. So this solidifies the process for them and makes it more likely that they're going to keep doing it. Third, I think Ella and the producers of The Daily did an excellent job of talking about and making it really real for people what OCD feels like. And they did this cool trick of playing Ella's voice kind of in the background over and over again, saying what her fear is. So she was saying, you're going to get sick. 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 And this is how Ella's brain was actually talking to her. A relentless attack. You're going to get sick. You're going to get sick. You're going to get sick. And it gives you, the listener, a real sense of what it must be like to be so stuck in a moment like that. I found myself feeling just really empathetic towards Ella and anyone who might be in that position, because I could really feel what it must be like and how hard it must be for them in that moment. And finally, the program that they found in Florida at the University of Florida, the Facing Your Fears Summer Camp, seemed to be really good. And if you go back and listen to my episode with David Yusko, he talked about using exposures to your fears as a way to help change the way that you engage with your obsessive thoughts. And that's exactly what Ella did. When her brain told her she would get sick, instead of fighting and saying, no, 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 which only caused it to keep going, she would say, yeah, you know what? You're right. I might get sick. And the way Ella put it is that was like it just stopped it dead in its tracks. As soon as I said that, it was like, oh. And that changed how she engaged with the thoughts and ultimately changed her behaviors. She no longer had to avoid things because she said, you're right. I might get sick. I don't have to avoid getting sick. And now she had more flexibility in how she could respond to thoughts and situations. So I think that it was just an excellent show, and it really helped demonstrate and bring to life what David Yusko discussed with us a while ago. And so I would recommend going back and listening to this episode of The Daily. It's called Our Fear Facer Makes a New Friend, and it aired on December 31st, 2019. And I'd also go back and listen to my conversation with David Yusko from April of last year, because I think they'll give you a lot of information and background about how exposure therapy works, why it works, and why you should be looking for that if you're struggling with a similar issue. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Jeff Ditzel about ketamine infusion therapy. We'll be back in a minute.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, and joining me now is Dr. Jeff Ditzel. He's a psychiatrist here in New York City, a former lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, and he served as a division psychiatrist in Iraq in 2005. And he's been using ketamine infusions as a treatment in his practice, and he's here to tell us all about it. Jeff, welcome to the show. You know, I've been thinking ketamine treatments, they are, you know, when I hear about them and when I've thought about them in the past, they've been like a club drug, something that people use to abuse and to use really for fun. And here you're saying that you use it medicinally, you're using it as a treatment. Is this a new thing, using ketamine medicinally?
You know, it's not. I think that it's only within the last few years that it's become more well-known to the lay public, and it's becoming a little more known as a modality. But really for the last 10 years, it's been used for treatment-resistant depression. And like most things in medicine, it was discovered serendipitously that it was basically useful for people who had depressive symptoms who were also at the time undergoing procedures where anesthesia was involved that involved ketamine, which continues today very commonly. But what some smart group of clinicians realized is that their patients who had received ketamine for anesthesia induction, they also happened to have a reduction in their depressive symptoms. And so mostly research at the National Institute of Mental Health began to look into this and publish a series of articles. And the modality has been really in use for over a decade, but probably it's just within the last 3 years that people have become aware of it.
So when I was a kid and ketamine was kind of making its
debut.
Yeah, when it was making its debut, it was kind of known. Special K is like, it's a horse tranquilizer, and that's mm-hmm. what you were using. Is that true? And you were saying something about that it was something for medicine, like people were using it for anesthesia. What was its medical use before this?
So it, you know, initially around the 50s or 60s, it came into being as a field anesthetic for people in battle. And it was found to be particularly good. So you could use it in the theater of war, and you could take a soldier and put him under. They would be completely out, and you could perform your procedure, and then you could get them relatively quickly back to a normal state. So there wasn't a lot of post-procedure sedation and things like that. So it's a very, very good anesthetic, and it's used very commonly still today for that. It's also used for pain management at higher doses, both anesthetic doses and pain management doses, much higher than we use for the relatively low doses for treatment-resistant depression. Having said that, it's also known by the lay public as a horse tranquilizer as well as a club drug. And I, you know, in these things, there's some seeds of truth. So as, you know, an anesthetic, it's very useful. And if you have, say like a horse where you have millions of dollars invested in it and you need to perform a procedure, you want to use something that not only is going to let you use that anesthetic, well, to get the procedure done and that it's well tolerated, but also when you're offboarding that anesthetic, that it does so relatively quickly, because the last thing you want is your million or 2 million or however million dollar horse bumping into things and, you know, being impaired for several days afterwards. So being that animals are much more susceptible to the effects of anesthetics, that particular anesthetic is so well tolerated that it was used in veterinary medicine. For the reason that it was very, very effectively used and very, very easily tolerated.
So it's a human anesthetic as well, and then was kind of used with animals because it has these very sort of soft side effects.
Yes, exactly that.
Oh, that's so interesting. And then mm-hmm. by chance, they realized that these soldiers who I would imagine if you had to do some kind of surgical procedure out in the field, like depression is a pretty common thing to happen after any kind of a surgery. And if you have all that PTSD, all of that trauma going on, and you had to have something happen to you that you needed some surgery, depression would be pretty common. You're saying that they were realizing that the depressive symptoms were less?
Yeah, so I think it was less in the population of soldiers and more in the population of patients in general, that these clinicians / researchers realized that people who were having anesthesia involving ketamine as an anesthetic, those who also had depression, their depression seemed to get better. And wow. So they began to do more studies, and they began to do more research, and they began to use this clinically, mostly research at the National Institute of Mental Health. And with series of papers and all that, I think it became more well accepted by the general medical establishment, and then slowly has come to the awareness of the lay public who are now looking for alternatives that work better than our medications. You know, unfortunately, our medications are only effective a third of the time as far as the antidepressants go. A third of the time, people don't have any reaction to it. And a third of the time, they tend to get worse. And then a third of the time, they get better. So with something like ketamine infusion therapy, which is, it sounds a little more invasive than it is, it's actually usually given as an IV over 40 minutes. And it's very, very well tolerated and actually an enjoyable experience because it's mildly psychedelic in the experience of it. The efficacy in a treatment-resistant group, so a group of patients who already have gone through usually several medication trials and nothing has really worked or worked well or worked for a long period of time, it's generally 65 to 75% effective in this very difficult to treat group to begin with.
That's twice as effective as your Prozacs or your Zolofts.
Some of the time, yeah, it's true. So we, you know, since we've been offering this therapy, which, you know, the issues with ketamine infusion in this country at this time is that it's not really particularly well systematized or put into protocol. So when I was looking into this, I started to drill down and I thought it was fascinating. I'd seen it go across my screen, I can't tell you the number of times, before it really caught my interest. And as I started to look into it, I saw the efficacy, of course, or the percentage of the time that it was useful to people. And so I started to dig down and I was like, well, I'd really like to go get training on this. But because it's been around for so long and it's been off patent for so long, there's really no impetus for the drug companies to develop this as a modality, which I think is the reason why it's only now coming to people's awareness as something other than a club drug and, you know, horse anesthetic or a horse tranquilizer. So as the application is starting to come to people's awareness, they're starting to look for alternatives in treatment that are, you know, more useful or oftentimes more useful than what we currently have. And it's really been a pleasure and a surprise to see, you know, the percentage of my private practice clientele who have treatment-resistant depression, which I'd say it's roughly 10 to 15%, have the chance to be offered this within the comfort of their own private practice, within the comfort of their relationship with their standing psychiatrist or their doctor, and receive this modality and get results and get them quickly. So the other thing about ketamine infusion, when it's effective, and we've seen it to be very effective in the practice, is it's effective very quickly. So instead of waiting the usual weeks or months that it takes to properly titrate or increase a antidepressant or medication used for anxiety or OCD or PTSD to the appropriate dose where it's effective, getting a full therapeutic trial, with ketamine infusion therapy, you can get results immediately or almost immediately, which
that's amazing.
A godsend. Yeah, and it's actually one of the only things that we do have in psychiatry that addresses acute suicidality. So I believe some ERs are actually giving this in an injection, an intramuscular injection, when they have people who are acutely suicidal. And it works, again, almost immediately.
That's pretty amazing. I'm going to ask you to walk us through the whole thing in a second, but I want to start by identifying, okay, so you're saying that this is not a first-line treatment. Somebody comes to you, they've never been on medication before, they've never done any kind of therapy before. They come to you and they say, I've been really depressed for a while. You assess and you say, yes, you have, you know, a major depressive episode or major depressive disorder that's been going on for a while. You wouldn't start them out on ketamine therapy, a ketamine infusion therapy, or you would?
Well, I mean, I guess that would depend on the acuity. So if someone showed up and, you know, again, it's a private practice setting. So if you were in the ER, for instance, and someone showed up and they were acutely suicidal and you had the ability to monitor within, you know, the highly structured setting of an emergency room without maybe getting the things that I would be comfortable with before I began someone on ketamine infusion therapy or ketamine. I would want to get lab work. I would want to get EKGs. I would want to do certain instruments to kind of characterize their depression or their anxiety. But if you're in an acute emergency setting, you might decide, okay, I'm going to give an IM injection of this at a very low dose to see if I can combat the suicidality. Okay. Again, I'm in a private practice, and as such, we have a little more time to plan. And there's basically a screener that we use to go through and get certain things like the appropriate lab work, the appropriate history, the appropriate screening tools like a Hamilton A or Hamilton D depression and anxiety score. So we have a good sense in an EKG. So we have a good sense going into it, you know, how healthy the client is and how likely they are to tolerate the ketamine infusion. But again, it's generally used for treatment-resistant depression, defined as depression that has been, in effect, treated and not treated as symptom remission, with at least one or two trials of medications that have failed. So the very definition of the patient population itself is one that has already failed, usually multiple trials of medications.
Okay, so you, what I'm hearing you say, and I just want to make sure I have this accurately, is that I probably would, if somebody came into your office and they've never done anything before, you'd probably say, all right, let's try, assuming that it's not super acute or that it's not highly suicidal, that you might say, all right, let's try a couple of different rounds of more traditional SSRIs or other medications and talk therapy first before we go into this, because we want to make sure that it's not going to be that what you were dealing with here is treatment resistant depression. Is that right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So you have to remember it's ketamine infusion, which is more effective than what is currently accepted by the FDA, which is intranasal ketamine application. Ketamine infusion is an off-label use of the medication, and the off-label use is for treatment-resistant depression. So doctors prescribe off-label, as you know, all the time. Sometimes patients don't know that because the doctors don't take enough time, I think, to, you know, explain what they're doing. But a lot of times doctors are using medications off-label, meaning other than their indication by the FDA to treat certain things. So the whole, you know, thing with ketamine infusion is that it's an off-label use of a specifically defined subset of your patient population, which by its very definition has tried other modalities like medications, like talk therapy, hopefully like what we do in this practice, proper nutrition, proper fit lifestyle. And having failed all those things, you would look at something like ketamine infusion therapy, much along the lines that you would look at things like transcranial magnetic stimulation, or further down the line, ECT or deep brain stimulation, which are much more invasive modalities. So to have something like ketamine infusion, which has the invasiveness essentially of just having an IV for 40 minutes, and have that degree of potential efficacy or good effect, and have it so well tolerated, and again without much invasiveness other than just having an IV for 40 minutes, it's an incredible thing to be able to offer, especially if you offer in conjunction with your current psychiatric care, preferably administered by a psychiatrist, and preferably if possible to be able to do therapy during the infusion, things like that, if the patient
Let's keep going. You meet with somebody, they've tried Prozac, they've tried a couple of different things, they've gone to therapists before, definitely they qualify for treatment-resistant depression, and you say, I think that this is something that we should do. What comes next? How does this begin, and what does an actual session look like?
Well, so what we do is we do a very thorough history. I'm an addiction psychiatrist as one of my fellowships. I have a few fellowships. So we do a very full history, including a chemical dependency history, and we try to make certain that the patient is going to be able to tolerate the medication and not get into issues with it. That includes a full medical workup. We get an EKG, and we really take the time to make sure medically and psychiatrically they're a good fit for the modality. And that includes the ability to be consistent in their treatment, because the initial series of treatments is a series of 6 infusions over the course of, you know, roughly 1 to 2 weeks. So they have to be consistent treatment. Now, you have to understand my private practice isn't a clinic. It's not a ketamine clinic. So my team's approach isn't one of, you know, we want to just hook everyone up to ketamine, which unfortunately there's a lot of these places that sprung up across the country, and that is their MO. Ours isn't that. We offer ketamine infusion to clients who've been our long-term clients, and occasionally people who seek us out from other places, right, from afar. But generally, we're a private practice that offers this as one of the modalities that we already do, which is different from just being a standalone ketamine clinic where, you know, you're basically the thing that you're offering is only ketamine infusion.
All right. Well, so, kind of like a Suboxone mill where it's, they're not talking to you and doing other stuff. They're just giving you Suboxone and getting you out the door.
Exactly. So we don't have multiple infusion rooms. We have one infusion room. When I do an infusion, I'm with the patient. And my staff's with the patient. It's very well monitored. We have a 3-lead EKG. We have pulse ox and, blood pressure cuff that goes off essentially every 5 minutes. And it's in a very calm setting with aromatherapy, and it's a state dependent sort of experience, meaning that you want it nice and calm and sort of comforting, because your experience of the infusion will influence the aspect of the infusion that is just your basically being comfortable and having an anxiolytic or anti-anxiety response. In that first part of the infusion itself, people tend to get a therapeutic benefit. And I like to think of these benefits that they get as three waves of benefit for an infusion. One is the actual therapeutic benefit of the infusion itself. So you're with your psychiatrist, you might be doing therapy. You might not. You might be quiet and just kind of reflecting on something that's been problematic with you and a loved one, or just some issue that you have. And it's mildly dissociative. You're awake the entire time, but you just have a different stance on things. Like, you're not as firmly attached to a physician, like you were wronged or someone did something bad to you. You might be able to look at it a little more objectively. So a lot of times people have had more than one infusion, I see them kind of getting in the chair that serves as our treatment chair, which is essentially a very comfy lazy boy. And they kind of sit back, and you can tell they've thought of something they want to bring to the table and work on. It might have been an argument they had with their spouse or something like that. And they can kind of approach and see it as if we were watching it on like Netflix. You know, they're just not as attached to their position. They can see the role they played in it. And at about 17 minutes in the infusion, 15 to 17 minutes, there's a very nice anxiolytic or calming effect that happens as well. And we can see that reflected in blood pressures and the vital signs that we're monitoring. The experience of the infusion itself is generally a very, very positive one. Again, you're not sedated, you're not knocked out, you're simply experiencing a mild psychedelic state. A lot of people will close their eyes because they enjoy sort of the difference in colors and textures that they might see, but they're fully awake the whole time, and they can simply open their eyes, and they know I'm there, and they know my staff's there, and all that stuff. Most times they keep it closed though, because it's kind of entertaining, you know, it's kind of enjoyable. And they go through the 40 minutes, and they usually get a benefit just from that. At about 60 minutes to 180 minutes post-infusion, there is a glutamate release, which is a neuroexcitatory peptide that your central nervous system makes normally, and there's a release of that. And in that wave of glutamate release, there's a benefit, mood benefit for depression. Then as the ketamine itself is metabolized over the course of days, there's another wave of therapeutic benefit that occurs there too.
I'm just thinking about the biofeedback piece of this, that you're saying, so that people are coming in and they're thinking about something that is potentially distressing or could be distressing to them, or that they've been working on, and they sit down in the chair and they're thinking about this, and then they're having about 15 minutes into thinking about this, their body's calming down. And I'm thinking, like, that has to rewire so much of, like, you know, if my body was speeding up and getting anxious in the way that it normally does, that would be, reinforcing the anxiety, like the, oh my God, yes, when I think about these things, it's so bad. But if I'm having a different response, that is, I think about these things, I'm working on it, and my body calms down, that's got to totally rewire your brain.
Yeah, I mean, it has been shown that there is synaptogenesis that occurs during these infusions or from these infusions. So there is like biological connections that are made, okay? But behaviorally, you know, for my clients who've been undergoing the initial series and then do the booster series, which we see the infusions lasting on the low end, this is just clinically now, what we see is on the low end, 2 weeks, and on the the high end, the duration of the infusions or the durability can be roughly 2 to 3 months, after which you would get a booster infusion or, you know, maybe two booster infusions. It's people who've had this over the course of some time now, what they've said is that the therapy that goes on, or the therapeutic aspect of this that goes on in the session, so after the initial series where you're just kind of marveling at this state and it's sort of the Disneyland experience of it, and you start to get to work with your doctor, your therapist, they've said that it's really, really been helpful to do therapy during these sessions because you just have a different way of thinking and relating to these things that allows you to gain some sort of objective stance that you can then use to start to work on healing from some of these things. So it's been really, really beneficial to our clients.
And that's also reminding me a little bit of the research that's coming out about psilocybin, about magic mushrooms, mm-hmm. and how they're doing that, and saying you just have more flexibility. You're able to relate to the information in a different way when you have a little bit of that. It kind of opens you up to more options and possibilities. Sounds like it's similar.
It's similar in that respect. It's funny that you mentioned that, because I just had someone call me about that today, and they were saying at the end of things they would send me the article on psilocybin and all that as it's applied therapeutically. But isn't it adaptability that helps in any range of things, whether it's sports performance or you know, quality of life enhancement, or you know, just being able to get along with a group of people? Your ability to adapt and to gain wisdom and then apply that wisdom is the thing that ultimately saves the day. You know as well as I do that our medications, you know, generally don't cure. They mm-hmm. serve as a tool. And so if you have another tool that allows people a moment to be calmly look at things a little bit differently and then adapt their behavior and they get a good result, that's the thing that ultimately is going to get them to the finish line, I think.
I totally agree with that. And I feel like we're slowly tapping into all of these real benefits that people have from the substances that are out there that exist in the world that people have used in different ways medicinally in the past, that, you know, we're finding new ways that it actually helps. And so it's just so interesting to me. So this is one of the things that I often think about, especially with marijuana, this happens is people say, well, I don't have to go to the medicinal marijuana place because I've got my dealer and I just smoke and it's fine. I get the benefit from mm-hmm. it. What you're describing is very, very different from casual use.
Yeah. So, I mean, casual use of any of these things can be extremely well-intentioned, but poorly applied, and you can have disastrous results. So, in the case of medical marijuana, which I actually did the training through the Department of Health for certification in medical marijuana in New York State, and the scientific basis of the medicinal modalities of that are I think very well laid out by that training. However, much the same way, if you aren't using the aspects of any potentially helpful medicine that can promote healing, and you use it in a way that can actually impair you or ultimately hurt you, then you're just not using it the proper way or with proper supervision. So ketamine infusion is much different from, you know, using ketamine in a club drug type of scenario. The orders of magnitude are in the club drug scenario are exponentially higher, hundreds of times higher. Often the dose of ketamine that we're using for an infusion it's rarely, at least in my practice, less than a milliliter. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking 0.5 milliliters or, you know, 0.6 milliliters. So it's just a teeny tiny little bit of this medication. Again, not to the point where you're sedated. Okay. So I think if used in the proper setting, with the proper intention, with good monitoring and trained personnel, paying attention to the state-dependent aspects of it, which is calm setting. We used Theta brainwave music, which is basically calm music that you might hear in an elevator or something, I suppose, but not realize, but it doesn't repeat, and it really doesn't have a thunderous beat or anything like that. It's very calm and relaxing, with low light, in a very enveloping, calm setting, then you can get an amazing response. And that's really what we see in the practice. It's not the cure all for everything. Essentially, everyone we've had come in to have this modality has benefited from it. That doesn't mean that it's going to benefit everyone.
Right.
But, you know, for the number that we've had, people have continued in treatment generally. The vast majority have continued in treatment. A lot of times they can decrease the amount of meds that they're using. Sometimes discontinue them and just go with ketamine infusion. But what we generally see is they're able to decrease the amount of meds that are in their current treatment regimen. So the aspect of their care that has to do with medication off can be reduced a little bit.
Oh, wow. So what would you say in like a short version to somebody who says, okay, fine, maybe this is for some people, but if you've had a substance use problem in the past, you obviously can't do this.
Yeah, I would say, again, there are seeds of truth to that. So if you're going to leave the conversation at a very basic level, then yeah, you can make that statement. I think that, you know, one of the indications for this is comorbidity that increase the likelihood of substance use and dependence. So, you know, if you have something like PTSD, if you have something like anxiety disorder or OCD that hasn't been treated, if you have treatment-resistant depression, there's likely going to be a comorbid substance use disorder somewhere in there. So if you have a modality that you can use, and you can use in a way that is very well supervised, and again, the infusion or the IV of ketamine, right, is completely under the supervision of a doctor, unlike the intranasal, which you could and you should apply it that way as a clinician. But, you know, the fact that the FDA approved that particular modality of the medication seems to me, you know, there's a high potential for misuse there. So I think as long as you have a very, very thorough assessment, as long as you have proper monitoring and proper personnel and supervision of what you're doing, I think that, you know, even if you have some substance use disorders, say alcohol use or cannabis abuse or something like that, as long as you're monitoring the situation, I think that this is still a potentially viable modality.
That's great. Thank you. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on. This was a really valuable and important thing. How can people find out more about you and your practice?
Well, they can simply look me up online. You know, we're happy to take on new clients and help, but that's really not the reason that I wanted to talk to you about this modality. If you someone wanted to look me up online, we have a website. It's Jeff Ditzel, and I'll come up all over the place on the internet. And you're welcome to call. And we have a staff that is essentially available all the time, and I'm certainly available all the time. But I really wanted to bring this modality up just because we're seeing that so effective to people. And I thought the conversation was really important for people to understand. So, but if you want to talk to me directly, they can. And it's jeffditzel.com. Really, really simple. So welcome to contact us, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody about this type of modality. But it's very useful to a lot of people, and it's very promising. And we've seen people come in at the beginning of the day, you know, suicidal and just have lost hope. And by the evening, we were able to get the proper lab work at the EKG and everything we needed to feel comfortable moving forward, give them an infusion, and 40 minutes later, they would look up at me. I've had this happen more than once and say, you know, I can't believe how good I feel after that. And I finally have hope after all this time.
And so what more could you ask for?
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining me on the show. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. And that is such a cool thing. I so appreciate Jeff coming on and talking about this, because that idea that people are going to show up in his office suicidal and then he's able to give this kind of treatment and do it so quickly and then find that they're like 40 minutes later, wow, I have hope. Like, that's amazing. What more could you want as a therapist or as a helper in general or as a human being who doesn't have any hope than to say, I needed some hope and now I've got some. And I know there are going to be people who listen to this and say, oh man, you are just playing with fire. This is just drugs and more drugs and more drugs, and people need to be off of this stuff. And I would say, I don't agree. I mean, if there is something out there that it kind of comes in and out of your system, and that we can do it in a way that is watched by doctors and thought through and really something that can be so helpful and that can take somebody's life and make it feel more full or more possible, I don't want to shun it. I don't want to say no to it. I want to be open to all of that. And, you know, here is a really, really cool and interesting thing. And we're just going to keep finding more and more of them. The research on psilocybin is really interesting. I keep trying to find people to come on the show to talk about it, because it is really, really interesting and really amazing what's out there. And the medicinal marijuana, we just had Junella Chin on here, and her stuff was just so cool. And I'm thinking, you know, man, the more that we're doing research on this and the more that we could be open-minded about it, the more we might find ways that this stuff can be really, really beneficial to people out there who need it. And, you know, I'm open to all of that. Next week, Dr. William Miller, one of the creators of motivational interviewing, is coming on the show, and that's going to be such a cool one. I was talking to him before and I was like, wow, this is going to be a really great show. If you haven't had a chance to rate and review this show, please go online and do it. Go on iTunes or wherever, Apple Podcasts, and if you think so, give me them 5 stars. But wherever you got this, rate this show, please. It really means a lot to me. Till next time, I am Dr. Josh King, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.